Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex here as always with Elaine.
Hey guys.
Today we're diving into chapters 25 through 27 of Chapter House Dune. So we're going to start off with Odrade as she visits a couple locales on Chapter House. And then we're going to catch up with the Honored Matres. So we're going to get some more Dama perspective. And then we're going to head back to Chapter House with Belanda as she hangs out with Duncan, I guess we'll say for now.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah.
All right, you want to kick us off with our first illuminating epigraph?
Sure, yeah, that's one way to put it. So, it's a quote from Darwi Odrade. "The best art imitates life in a compelling way. If it imitates a dream, it must be a dream of life. Otherwise, there is no place where we can connect. Our plugs don't fit." So, I don't have jack shit for this. I read it about five times, and I did not comprehend any meaningful takeaway from it.
Yeah, do you want to know what my notes for this epigraph say?
What?
Odrade has more opinions about art that I don't care about.
Yeah, I honestly, I got nothing for this. It was, yeah. Let's move on.
All right. So, in the chapter, finally, Odrade and her retinue actually set out to see Shiana in the desert, like half a book after she first said, "I need to go see Shiana." But if you were hoping that she would actually make it there by the end of the chapter, spoiler alert, you'll be disappointed. They get about halfway there. They are traveling in a pair of overland vehicles, allowing Odrade to see the increasingly dry countryside as they drive past. Clearly different even from when she was last here 3 months ago. She's annoyed at the size of her entourage, as Tamerlane had apparently decided that it was necessary to bring a small army of Bene Gesserit functionaries. So there are 15 of them in the first vehicle that Odrade is in, and an entire bus full of sisters and acolytes and equipment behind them. Tamerlane herself had been banished to this second vehicle for bringing along more of an invasion force than an inspection force, as Odrade keeps joking. There's an odd note from Odrade thinking that she wants Tam to play along with her dramatics, to give the people political drama and, quote, make transition easier, unquote. And it makes me wonder if she means Tamerlane being replaced as this transition, or if she's paving the way for her own replacement by just being weird and crotchety so that eventually people will be like, "Oh yeah, remember when Odrade was Mother Superior? That was weird. Glad we have someone more normal now." Like, I wasn't quite clear what that line meant. Because we still don't know her plan, and it's possible that she too suffers from the Decian gesture of her lineage and plans to go out with a bang. Streggy also notices the dryness of the environment and asks if they couldn't get weather to make it rain here, but an annoyed Odrade ignores her like a, "Come on, you know the answer to this." Odrade already seems to be in something of a dark mood, as just before they had been ready to set out, she had been delayed by an urgent message from Belanda that another 4 of their 16 planets had been obliterated, although Bazel thus far has been spared. This means that only 12 planets remain to the Bene Gesserit. Odrade had ordered Belanda to keep the information to herself until a more appropriate moment, and Odrade had set off on her journey. They drive through hills of oak trees that had been allowed to grow over the original orderly lines of a plantation, as a place where the Bene Gesserit grow and harvest truffles, which Odrade points out. However, Streggy breaks the bad news to her that the truffles are suffering from the lack of rain, the horror of which tempts Odrade to summon an acolyte to order weather control to try to get some rain out here after all. So Streggy asks if we can't make it rain a little bit more, and Odrade gives her, like, the cold shoulder, and then as soon as Streggy mentions that the precious truffles are in danger, she's like, maybe we should get some rain out here. Odrade likes the finer things. Eventually, they pass through the hills and start to drive through fruit tree orchards surrounding a village. Odrade notes the trees are still leafless, but she's hopeful that they will bear fruit at least one more time. She muses on the functional aesthetic of the sisterhood's construction, ensuring that their gardens and orchards support the needs of both their bodies and their minds. Someone points out that some of the trees are, in fact, showing the beginnings of leaves, which Odrade sees after looking more closely. She recognizes that weather control must have lost some of their control here, trying as they are to deal with the expanding desert without completely disrupting the planetary weather systems. One side effect is that sometimes you get warm spells that come too early and throw off the growing cycles of crops, since the cold will soon come back and kill things, and this is already having negative consequences. We learn that this place is called Pundriel, and it is one of many communities that serve as postulant centers for the Sisterhood on Chapter House. So it's used to screen the populace for potential sisters, apparently with the schools filtering more and more harshly with physical proximity to Central. Some of the communities focus on toughening up the potential sisters through manual labor, which apparently makes the women thus trained less likely to resist being called the dirty tasks later on. So I guess one of the things we learn from this chapter is that in addition to all of the sisters here on Chapter House, there are just a lot of fairly ordinary people, mm-hmm. enough to have like whole cities and villages and such in addition to the actual populace of the sisters. So they, I guess, just like check out all potential female children as possible sisters, mm-hmm. depending on their temperaments and traits and such.
Unless they sort of just plan them throughout the population.
I mean, they could, but, like, I'm sure a lot of people also just, like, couple up naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's possible.
And, like, some of those children might be good potential sisters, like, if they perform well in school or demonstrate other traits of use.
Mm-hmm. Like Teg did, I guess.
Yeah, although he was... I guess I don't know if he specifically was, like, bred as, like, oh, they wanted a male with Atreides' traits, or it was more of a, like, anchoring point for Janet and Lashi or whatever, like, keeping their relationship together. Kind of interesting. But, yeah, he was the child of a reverend mother. But you can imagine, like, you can have, like, a Marbella who was not part of a breeding program but is still a useful candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, approaching Pundriel, the driver opens the windows now that they are out of the dust of the open areas, and Odrade is horrified at how hot it's become here. They enter Pundriel through an arched tunnel leading into the town, which Odrade mentally compares to a castle gate with a portcullis due to the building materials that resemble greystone. Pundriel is clean and well-maintained, as expected from Bene Gesserit communities, which don't have slums and have few cripples, they're sure to inform us.
Important statistic.
Yeah. Apparently due to their cultivation of a healthy and happy population through good management. Which is the kind of thing that could just mean what it says in the face, but could also be, like, a very dystopian euphemism, depending on how it's used. However, despite the minimal cripples, Odrade ominously notes that we have our disabled, though, and not all of them physically. Which doesn't really get any further elaboration, so I'm not sure what exactly this refers to.
Mm-hmm.
Are people just, like, mentally traumatized from living under Bene Gesserit rule?
Well, they will be once there's no more truffles.
Well, as we see in this chapter, the farmers and such here are already somewhat in revolt over their dying fruit trees. So, the vehicles park, and they all emerge into the oppressive heat, requiring Odrade to adjust her metabolism to deal with it. So, no word on how the non-Bene Gesserit members of the party, like the driver, are expected to deal with the conditions, let alone the people who live here, and maybe can't just adjust their metabolisms. Odrade notes a water feature in the middle of the square, which she knows can't be permitted here for much longer, but for now, she says nothing so as not to affect morale. Unsurprisingly, many members of the party head over there, attracted by the water, and some even splash their faces. A delegation of Reverend Mothers and Advanced Acolytes approaches Odrade and Streki, who had stayed with her Mother Superior rather than heading to the fountain. The locals are led by a woman called Simpe, who occasionally comes up to Central to teach. She greets Odrade and says she's glad to see her, and as Odrade notes the sincerity, she wonders why they're actually glad to see her. The question is shortly answered as Simpe introduces another Reverend Mother in the party, Folly, who is the Orchard Mistress, which I feel like is Odrade's dream job.
Yeah.
Folly has just brought a delegation of the farmers under her oversight to Simpe with a serious complaint. Odrade notes that Folly looks a bit overworked, but approvingly notes that she has dirt beneath her fingernails, indicating that she engages in the work herself. She thinks that this delegation and their complaint must have been serious indeed, as it's rather unlike Simpe to escalate something like this to Odrade herself. She indicates that Folly should proceed, and the woman explains. Listening, Odrade muses about how they had anticipated this exact problem. They can't exactly tell the general populace that they are actively desertifying the planet to benefit a potential future sandworm population that doesn't 100% exist yet. and that, as a result, they can't just locally make the weather better or different here or in any other specific area, because they have to contend with the planet-wide weather and climate patterns that could spin out of control. Odrade does note that despite this context, she herself has made petty demands of weather control from time to time, as we've witnessed. Odrade alludes to this issue of the whole planetary context in her reply, and Folly bitterly references Dune, whose weather no longer matters. Odrade says that she feels the heat and sees the early leaves in the trees, trying to indicate that she understands the frustration and the scenario. But in reply, Folly accusingly states that part of the crop is going to be lost. However, despite her personal frustration and bitterness, which she's revealed to Odrade, Folly had told the delegation of farmers the limited truth, that the desert has to grow, and weather control just can't make local adjustments that easily. Odrade knows that eventually they'll need to share more with the people. In the meantime, there will be more angry delegations as the crop problems only grow as the planet gets hotter and drier. It does really suck for everyone else who lives here, because it's all fine and dandy for Odrade and her people to say, like, well, we're going to turn this whole planet into a desert for sandworms. And then all the people who live on Chapter House and can't just, like, get up and leave because they don't have access to a no-ship. And it's not like there's commercial space travel to and from a secret base planet. Mm-hmm. So all these people are just kind of, like, trapped here with Odrade mostly unilaterally changing their planet and their lives for the worse. It kind of sucks.
Yeah.
So at this point, Simpei invites Odrade to tea, having made her point by allowing Folly to make hers. At the invitation, Strike clears her throat conspicuously, which seems to unduly annoy Odrade, who's like, we'll have to stamp out that reflex. But she does recognize that Strike, who is in charge of the schedule, is trying to tactfully remind her that they're already running late. So Odrade declined, saying that they had only stopped to stretch their legs and check in, and Simpei reassures her that they can handle the angry gardeners without further intervention. Odrade is pleased with Simpei's obvious pride in maintaining her community in good order, and she tells the woman that she's heard good things of her. She makes a loud and pointed comment about not wanting to continue imposing on them with their far too large entourage. They briefly discuss that Odrade's party is going to stop in Eldio, with Odrade getting in another dig at Tamlane's gigantic entourage, and Simpei warns her that she has heard the sea in Eldio has been noticeably shrinking. Folly steps forward and briefly tries to beg for some kind of intercession from Odrade, but the Mother Superior just coldly informs her that the gardeners have the choice to stay here and keep grumbling until the Honored Matres find Chapter House and enslave them, or to go out into the new scattering. With those harsh words, Odrade heads back to the car, and her party sets off again. The atmosphere in the car is tense, and she knows that the other sisters are analyzing her behavior back in Pondreal. She reflects on how the weather has gotten so bad now that there isn't really anything to say to assuage the concerns of the ordinary people, or of the sisters. And while no one will directly challenge or criticize Odrade herself, they will complain about the weather as a sort of proxy for, like, how bad things are. On the transport, Strike opens conversation with Odrade, having become much less intimidated by her due to their increased proximity. They have a discussion about manuals, which Strike is used to learning from through her acolyte training, but Odrade dismisses as dangerous because manuals create habits. Some habits are unavoidable, and there is some kind of allusion to Sightail's so-called typicals of the Bene Gesserit. But the sisters consider it important to ensure that they are as unpredictable as possible. However, this seems to be taken to something of an extreme, as when Strike makes the excellent point of, okay, well, then what's the point of manuals? Odrade replies that the point is mainly to disprove them. I think with the implication that once you've learned them in your lower levels, you advance to the higher levels and they are immediately disproven. But that seems kind of like somewhat a waste of time, so I'm kind of on Shreggy's side here.
Yeah, I kind of took it as she was getting more at that, you know, any kind of manual is only going to contain the information within the manual, and there's other things you could learn outside of it that it won't tell you, just because, you know, like any book, it's contained by a certain number of pages that can provide a certain amount of information. Which is just, it's like the most Bene Gesserit argument you could make about something like this.
Yeah, and I mean, she goes on shortly to be like, history is also all nonsense. And it's just like, well,
nice, not everything statement is nonsense.
Like, there's useful information in the manuals just because, like, sometimes they don't apply to all scenarios or, like, there are exceptions to the rules doesn't mean that they're dangerous in habit forming. I don't know. But yeah, so she criticizes histories, saying that they're biased, and once Striggy has the other memory, she will relearn history for herself. And it's like, she doesn't have all of history. Like, matrilineal lines only show at best half of things. And even then, it's not like you have the memories of every woman who's ever lived, you know. Mm-hmm. You can see some of history, but not all of it. So, in any case, Strike E replies that truth is an empty cup, which Odrade approves of, and it makes her smile, thinking that her acolyte is a jewel. But it's in a weirdly demeaning sort of way, where she goes on about how jewels can be identified by their flaws, and of course manages to bring Van Gogh into it, making the argument that he wouldn't have been who he was without such impurities. In any case, Odrade basically says at this point, histories are largely useless except as records of dates of events, the truth of which the Reverend Mothers tried to dig into with their memories. And Strike E seems rightfully annoyed that so much of her time has been wasted on these apparently pointless and biased histories. Odrade doesn't really address that particular point of like, okay, well, why have I spent the past however many years studying these then? But she simply tells Strike E to wait until she has her true insight from other memory, where she will see the truth of past events. But yeah, that seems partially true, but like, unless she's getting not just her own other memory, but like memories from other people, there's going to be people and parts of history you won't have access to as an individual person with other memory. Not to mention that you won't have memories of any interactions in which only men were present. Mm-hmm. Which, unfortunately, was a lot of old history.
Yeah, especially, like, most wars.
Yeah, or, like, governments before women were allowed, or, like, elected in large numbers, so. And even up until the old empire that we saw in Dune, like, we never saw or had reference to any female leaders of, like, great houses. Like, the only really female power players were the Bene Gesserit and, like, the Reverend Mothers on Dune. But, like, Jessica was a concubine. There was never any indication that a woman could inherit, like, Leto wanted a son so that he would have an heir. So it seems that that was also true up until the beginning of what we saw.
Yeah, I guess even with, like, the Carinos, when Sisha was, like, kind of running the show, but Faradin was kind of, like, the, you know, leader of the house. He was just young.
Yeah, and because when Sisha's husband had died or something... Like, what happened? Who was Faradin's dad?
Well, the Emperor was his grandfather, right? I don't think we ever knew who his father was.
Yeah, so. So, I mean, that could be why when Sisha was allowed to run things, the Emperor didn't have any sons. I just feel like, given that the sisters' other memories are limited to the perspectives of women in their family line, unlikely that they were going to witness all of history through their other memories. In any case, Odrade and Strege discuss how the other memories will allow or even force Strege to change her viewpoint frequently. And Strege confesses that this sounds like a confusing approach to morality that she isn't sure she'll like. Odrade is impressed with her insight and forthrightness, but again, frames it as brilliant facets among Strege's impurities. And it's like, can't you just compliment the girl, even in your head?
Apparently not.
Odrade thinks about how the sisterhood has long since decided that each sister must be responsible for making her own moral decisions, rather than blindly following those of their leaders, so they start moral conditioning young. Hard to tell if this is just good upbringing versus indoctrination. Odrade wonders if part of the reason that a moral flaw, as she considers it, has gotten into Shiana, presumably referring to her unsanctioned sexual escapades, among other things, is because she came into sisterhood training too late. Odrade wonders what Shiana and Duncan speak about with their semi-secret hand language. Back in the present with Strege, she tells the Acolyte that moral decisions are where one abandons working for oneself. And Strege seems weirdly blown away by the very concept, commenting that this must take a lot of courage. But Odrade disagrees, saying that such decisions are essentially natural, undertaken when there is no other choice. Strege comments that Odrade makes her feel ignorant sometimes, and Odrade says this is a good thing, and that you should always interrogate why you do what you do without assuming that it's for good reasons. They finally approach Eldio, and Odrade asks her driver to stop in a place she often likes to stop when she comes this way, overlooking the city and the surrounding area. The city is to the left, with windmills installed throughout to help provide power. To the right is the sea, greatly diminished, as promised, which saddens Sea Child. There had been fishing villages at the water's edge, but now they are so far away from the shoreline that residents had either left in the scattering or had to build a tram to get their boats to the water. Odrade is both glad and sad at the progress and at the cost of it. Odrade orders the driver to take them down to the water, as she wants the opportunity to swim in the sea while she still can. However, despite Tamerlane's overpreparedness, she was apparently not ready for this particular eventuality. So Odrade has no appropriate swimming clothes and thus swims in the nude.
As one does.
As one does. This is such a weird thing because it's like she's the leader of the Bene Gesserit, so it's like you're at a company outing and the CEO just decides to skinny dip in front of all of his employees. Or her employees. Either way, weird. Especially because it's not like this is a big group activity because it's only Odrade, Streggy, and two other acolytes who actually go swimming. And everyone else just kind of wanders around watching the bizarre tableau. But for her part, Odrade feels newly energized and restored by being back in the sea. But she wonders how long they can maintain this sea, even in its current diminished state, until the desert must take everything. She thinks of it pragmatically, not allowing herself sentimentality over the feeling of being in the sea, and comes to the conclusion that the very existence of the sea itself at this time is a danger to the already challenging weather stability, and that this danger outweighs the sea's benefits in providing food, and it's going to eventually die anyway. Her sea child memories interfere, bringing nostalgia into things and making her want to keep the sea for as long as she can. But ultimately, Odrade decides it would be better to rip the bandage off and get the destruction of the sea, the loss and necessary relocations of people here, over with. She swims over to Tamerlane and orders her to have plans drawn up to get rid of the sea as quickly as possible. Tamerlane collects some sisters to help before heading off to carry out these orders, but not before throwing an I told you so look Odrade's way about the large entourage being helpful. Odrade gets out of the water, and in a savage and deeply weird move, doesn't bother to dry herself off, just getting dressed and getting her clothes all wet and letting them chafe as she walks up the beach away from the group. It's like, I'm sure someone had a towel or an extra robe or something. Who gets out of the ocean dripping wet and just puts their, like, robe back on? It just seems, like, deeply uncomfortable and gross. Not to mention all the sand is just gonna stick to you. In any case, despite her uncomfortable clothing choices, Odrade tells herself that past joys must simply remain memories, as all things shall pass eventually. She turns to look back at the sea, which she has just sentenced to an early death. She tells herself that life is all that matters, although of course she means human and Bene Gesserit life. She clearly isn't too fussed about the death of the whole ecosystem here. Survival of humanity and the sisterhood is paramount, and any single individual cannot get in the way of this. She takes one last deep breath of salt air to satisfy Sea Child before getting back in the car to head into the city. So we've made it at least halfway to Shiana in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a chapter where not a ton really happens plot-wise, but I don't have as much of a problem with it because it's kind of showing us the repercussions of Odrade's decisions on the rest of Chapter House.
Mm-hmm.
It's giving us these little vignettes of like, well, these people were already losing their sea, and now Odrade is killing it entirely, and the angry orchard workers who their crops are dying. I think it's just nice to get a perspective outside of the Bene Gesserit power structure in Central.
Yeah, you get to see the wider impact.
Yeah.
But I also thought it was an interesting Odrade perspective where at the beginning of the chapter, you know, she's like, oh, I need to save the truffles. And then by the end of it, you know, we have Sea Child herself, like, I'm going to kill the sea.
Yeah.
So she kind of, like, goes from trying to care about the little things and keep some things intact to just, you know, burn it all down because in the end, only humanity matters. And
yeah,
what we're building here in terms of, you know, desert power, I guess, to throw back to the first book.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get those worms.
Yeah, and, like, it's all going to happen eventually, so why prolong it? If she can get rid of the sea now and it'll help stabilize the weather a bit, then that's all for the good, even if it's personally painful for her.
Mm-hmm. You do what you gotta do.
She's gotta go take a vacation to Caladan.
If it's still around.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if we've heard anything about the fate of Caladan, specifically. Or Dan, it's called now, right?
Yeah, good old Dan.
Yeah, actually, I never really thought about that, because I thought about it in terms of, like, it's a shortening of Caladan, but it is kind of funny to have a planet just called Dan.
It's like Bob. There's a planet called Bob.
Yeah. Have you been to Dan lately? I hear Dan's nice this time of year. Anyway, let's move on to our next chapter, unless you have anything else to say about Odrade's trip.
I do not.
All right.
All right, so our next epigraph is from the Mentat Zen Sufi. Uproot your questions from their ground, and the dangling roots will be seen. More questions. So I think this just points to, like, any kind of research or investigation you do where you kind of go in with questions, and then as you figure some things out, you'll end up with more questions, and those kind of, you know, spiderweb their way around to bring you more questions, and that kind of goes on and on until you feel like you can conclude whatever research you were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I basically agree with that. And I'm not sure if, like, the Mentet Zen Sufi was, like, a specific person or, like, a book or something, but mm-hmm. as usual, it's not always clear from the epigraph attribution.
I'm assuming it's some Mentat master text or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we don't really know.
All right. So in this chapter, we're going to check back in with Spider Queen for what I think is the first time since she kicked Lucilla's head in, if I recall correctly.
We might have had one check-in since then. I don't entirely remember, though. Okay. But yeah.
In any case, she's feeling good about herself. She feels like she's at the top of her game as the so-called Spider Queen hunting the witches in her new control center located on Junction. She has some quibbles with the guild-influenced design of the place, but she's getting used to it, and it started to feel like a real home, as if her people had never been chased by Futars into the old empire, and she was still back on her home planet of Dur. She stands looking out into the botanical garden of the complex, as Logno waits behind her. Apparently, Logno isn't allowed to get too close behind Spider Queen, who would kill her for the attempt, presumably due to the whole murder your superiors to advance mentality. We learn from her thoughts that unlike Odrade with the changing climate on Chapter House, Spider Queen can order weather to produce a sunny day on a whim, and she expects it to be done. Spider Queen is thinking about an interesting report from Logno, that Dortujla, not named but we can tell from the context, has returned to Bazel and is said to be angry. Spider Queen's interpretation is that, obviously, the woman had known she was under observation, had gone to Bene Gesserit HQ to ask to be removed from her post for her own protection, and had been denied. Her read is that the sisters don't care about protecting their various people and planets as long as their central base remains undiscovered and untouched. She orders Logno to have the old witch brought to her, as well as all of her attendants. Lest we be concerned that this will be a particularly cordial meeting, she also orders Logno to start having some Futar starved, so that they will be hungry for Dortujla's visit to Junction. So, not sure about the odds of Dortujla's survival of this encounter.
Yeah, or at least some of her
entourage.
Entourage, yeah.
Yeah. So Logno leaves to go carry out these orders, and some other woman steps into her place, whom Spider Queen doesn't bother to identify because she considers her age interchangeable, except in the degree of threat they represent, with Logno the highest of those given her status and ambitions. She breathes deeply of the fresh air and is determined that today will be a good day because that is her will. She allows herself to dredge up her most secret memories and exults in the idea that they have successfully found a place in which to rebuild their strength. They're making significant progress on consolidation of the old empire, and she doesn't seem too worried about their chances of eradicating the Bene Gesserit. She is, however, a bit concerned about Ix. She wonders if perhaps she should not have killed two Ixian scientists the previous day. Apparently, they had made the mistake of daring to ask her for more information about the device the Matres know as the Weapon, which she had charged them with discovering a way to rearm, although they weren't actually told it was a weapon. It doesn't really seem surprising that she gave them a task with incomplete information and they were unable to accomplish it, in my opinion. Hey, here's this device that I won't tell you what it does, but fix it for me. Okay. Unhelpful. In any case, she talks herself into thinking that it was actually a good idea to kill them, since she isn't sure if they'd manage to figure out for themselves that it was, in fact, a weapon, and that wouldn't be good for them to know. So I just enjoy that she starts off questioning, like, maybe I shouldn't have done this impulsive thing, and then by the end of it, she's like, nope, I was definitely right. Good move, Spider Queen. I'm great. She also feels that the deaths teach the Ixians a lesson. If the Matres task you with something, bring them answers, not questions. Even if you don't have answers, because it's an absurd ask to begin with. Spider Queen reflects on how much she likes the new order she and her sisters are imposing here in their new home. She is dissatisfied with what she considers the existing disorderliness, with the disparate religions and cultures and traveling between places. They plan to impose the worship of Guldur on the populace, which Spider Queen doesn't really feel any mystical connection to, but believes is a useful tool. It helps that the religion is based on that of the old empire figures of Leto and his father Muad'Dib. Spider Queen views the religion as a way to impose the tyranny of the minority cloaked in the mask of the majority, which rings a little too uncomfortably close to current politics in some ways. Apparently, it was Lucilla's perception of this, and her demonstration of the Bene Gesserit's ability to manipulate populations, that had both led Spider Queen to decide she was too dangerous to live, and made her even more determined to wipe out the sisters, all of whom are taught the things that Lucilla knows. So if Lucilla knew it, so do all the other sisters, and they're just as dangerous. Spider Queen finds this ludicrous, believing that such knowledge should be kept as need to know as possible, and the idea of the Bene Gesserit just teaching it to all of their acolytes strikes her as wild. Logno returns, which Spider Queen can tell from her furtive footsteps. She reports that Dortruzla and company will be brought from Bazel, and the Futars will be starved. Spider Queen also orders Logno to increase security on the Futar cages, because apparently three had escaped the previous night and had been wandering around the garden in the morning. Logno says it was already dealt with. For no apparent reason, Spider Queen tells Logno not to tell her that the Futars are harmless without a handler, as Logno replies by saying she doesn't believe that that's true, and Spider Queen thinks that this is the truth, for once, and that Logno is genuinely terrified of the Futars. So Spider Queen tells Logno that she thinks that this is the power base they've been looking for, turning towards her aid, and noticing that Logno is 2 millimeters into the danger zone, forcing Logno to back up. Spider Queen thinks to herself that Logno can get as close as she wants in front of her, but never behind her back. Logno sees orange in Spider Queen's eyes and almost kneels before her, trying to blame it on being eager to serve her. Spider Queen thinks to herself that it is more likely that she is eager to replace her. Spider Queen asks what had happened to Rebecca, and Logno reports that she and some of her companions can't be found, though she says it's temporary, as they can't leave the planet, so they'll eventually track them down. The two of them go back and forth a bit, and Spider Queen states that Rebecca is still serving in her role as bait, as there was a reason that Lucilla had been found with Rebecca's people. And at this, she dismisses Logno. Spider Queen muses about how there are always rebel groups, and she mostly considers them a nuisance, disturbing the orderly lives of everyone around them, frustrated that one must clean up after such disturbances. She reflects that the Honored Matre's own success had cost them their empire out in the scattering, as it had made their enemies wish to cut them down. She's determined that they will not lose their success in this new stronghold. She thinks with glee about the many planets they've captured, and it's a long list, including many unfamiliar, but a few familiar names. And that's the end of the chapter. Yeah, so not a super long chapter, but it checks us in with the Honored Matres, and importantly, kind of moves the plot along in relation to Dortruzla, in that they have basically fallen for Dortruzla and Odrade's ploy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll have to see if the rest of it goes according to plan, but at least we're off to a good start there.
Yep. The question is, how many bowls of oyster stew and recollections of a Van Gogh painting will we have to wade through to get to that plot point?
Great question.
But regardless, let's move on to Belanda and Duncan.
Yes, let's.
Our third epigraph today is from The Coda. Humans are born with a susceptibility to that most persistent and debilitating disease of intellect, self-deception. The best of all possible worlds and the worst get their dramatic coloration from it. As nearly as we can determine, there's no natural immunity. Constant alertness is required.
Yeah, so this is the very novel observation that human beings are prone to self-deception, with a rather less than optimistic outlook for their resilience to that trait.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to this. This seems pretty self-evident from human behavior. It is very easy to be convinced of a particular worldview from things as simple as, like, you misremembered something and enough time has passed that you can no longer remember, like, where you saw it, so you don't fact-check it, and it just becomes part of your, like, knowledge base, even though it's not actually true.
Yep.
To, like, full-blown conspiratorial thinking where you just are completely convinced of something despite all evidence to the contrary, or there's just no evidence to support your position.
Right.
So yeah, not much to add there.
Okay, we can just move into the chapter then.
Okay, it's a doozy. So Belanda decides to live up to everyone's worst expectations of her, and basically as soon as Odrade leaves Central, takes this golden opportunity to try to engineer a scenario in which she can kill Duncan while claiming that she had no choice but to do so. To herself, she declares that he is simply too dangerous to be allowed to live. She gets herself to the no-ship as quickly as possible, before anyone spying for Odrade could get a message out to the Mother Superior. Although, from the first chapter that we read today, it doesn't really seem like any messages of that sort go through to Odrade. On her way over, Belanda goes over her analyses of Duncan's previous lives. His early incarnations had been impulsive, quick to both hate and love. This impulsiveness was never really lost, perhaps explaining the inability to give up the long-lasting Atreides' loyalty, but was eventually overlaid with cynicism, which I think was quite clear in the Duncan of the end of Leto's reign that we saw in the God Emperor. Mm-hmm. Cynicism was definitely present in his personality makeup there.
Yeah.
In any case, the lasting impulsivity tells Belanda that a common trait of all of the Golas is that they can be goaded into rash behaviors by pride, which is what she plans to make use of here. During her review, she is fascinated at the reminder that he had not only been a mentat in previous lives, but also possibly a truthsayer during some of his many lives with Leto. Belanda agonizes over why Odrade simply seems to not see why Duncan is so dangerous, which isn't helped by the fact that Odrade often speaks of him with obvious emotion in her voice when she describes the traits she appreciates in him, particularly his clear-mindedness, which she apparently finds restorative, and the fact that she openly admits that she personally likes him and that it influences her decisions around him. So, to someone like Belanda, she's like, okay, so you're admitting that your emotions influencing your decision-making about him and you don't think that's a problem? And Odrade's like, nope. Which seems par for the course with Odrade.
Yeah.
So, as she arrives at the new ship, Belanda finds Duncan at his console, alone. He tells her that he's been expecting her, and then opens a door to admit the young Gola of Miles Teg, who stares at Belanda. Duncan has made no preparations for Belanda's presence, despite saying that he expected her, so she's forced into the undignified move of dragging a chair in from his adjacent bedroom. She doesn't know what to make of his greeting that he was expecting her. He knows what she's thinking, and explains that Odrade had earlier told him that she was going to see Shyanna, and he knew that once that happened, it wouldn't be long until Belanda showed up here. So, predictable.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a kid being like, oh, mom's not home, time to raid the snack cabinet, except in this case, mom is Odrade, and raiding the snack cabinet is murdering Duncan.
I also find it interesting that based on the way Frank has written Belanda, and he keeps talking about how, like, fat she is, you decided to use a snack cabinet analogy.
That was not intentional on my part. I would never. Belanda can eat as many snacks as she wants, and that's her business. Whatever Odrade has to say about it. So, after Duncan basically says he made this inference from what Odrade told him, despite the obvious conclusion that he just made a simple mentat projection from the available data of Odrade's leaving Belanda in charge, and Belanda wants to kill me, she accuses Odrade of having warned him, which he denies. Belanda first demands to know what his and Shyanna's secrets are, and he just says that she wants to use him the same way the Sisterhood does, which Belanda links to the mission area. Duncan basically tells her to stop playing games on this level. They're both mentats, can't they interact like that? Belanda takes a deep breath and tries to get into that headspace, which is difficult under the circumstances, with Miles staring at her and Duncan's obvious amusement. Or at least his projection of obvious amusement. She fears that Odrade has been working with Duncan against her. For his part, whatever apparent amusement he was showing, Duncan does relax a bit when he sees her go from angry Bene Gesserit into at least more focused mentat mode. He outright tells her that it's no secret to him that she's wanted him dead for a long time, and she admits to herself that she hasn't exactly hidden that particularly well from anyone who cared to look, Duncan included. Duncan recognizes that he has just had a pretty close call with her murderous impulses, and he correctly diagnoses that she had come here with the clear intent to kill him, with the plan to provoke him into a dramatic encounter in which she would have had so-called just cause to kill him. Self-defense. Duncan doesn't even question that she could have easily killed him, indicating that despite her age and Odrade's comments about her weight, Belanda is still an extremely formidable Bene Gesserit, as befits a ruling sister of the Mother Superior's Council. But, he thinks, now that she is in mentat mode, she will consider more before committing to such an action. So, hardly out of danger, but it's a little bit less immediate. I do find it a little bit surprising that he doesn't even consider that he might win in that fight. I guess I would have expected it to be, I don't know, something of a fair fight, but he just seems to accept, like, yeah, she'd kill me.
Yeah. It is interesting.
But, I mean, she's, like, the second or third in command of the whole Bene Gesserit order, so, like, on that level, I guess that tracks.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we do discuss later in this chapter that Belanda thinks that Mirbella could kill her, so on the hierarchy of who could kill who, it's a little bit unclear. In any case, despite being a little bit calmer, Belanda still seems to be in a fighting mood, and she challenges Duncan on the disrespect of using her and Odrade's first names, or maybe not first names, but, like, whatever public name the Bene Gesserit use.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we probably don't know Belanda's full name. Like, they all have, well, except for Odrade, they all seem to have those triple names, but I don't think we know her first two, just Belanda. In any case, Duncan argues that it recognizes the way that he's trying to relate to her, not as Reverend Mother and Gola, but as two human beings with a common problem. She doesn't answer this point, but looks around, asking why he doesn't have Mirabella here as protection and or human shield if he had expected Belanda to come here and kill him. He's like, what, so that she would have had to kill Belanda to protect him? And Belanda admits to herself that Mirabella probably could actually kill her, which probably wouldn't work out so great for Mirabella after the fact, given that I imagine the Bene Gesserit would retaliate for such a transgression.
Unless they ended up in some sort of a scenario where Mirabella had to take the other memories or something. Well, I guess she's not a Reverend Mother yet, but...
She probably doesn't know how. Although, yeah. I wonder if the person taking the memories has to do it, or, like, can someone who has the memories, like, forcibly give them to someone else?
I would assume not, because you gotta, like, go through the spice agony, right? That would probably, be probably so overwhelming that it would just kill you.
Yeah.
If you even could do that, which I don't think you probably could.
But assuming, let's pretend Mirabella had gone through the spice agony, could, like... Could you just, like, be dying and just, like, put your hand on someone's head and just, like, force them in, or do they have to?
Yeah, I would assume so. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's what happened with Lucilla, right? And then eventually Rebecca.
I mean, at least with Lucilla and Rebecca, it was, like, a deliberate and willing thing. Like, I'm saying, if you're dying and the person, like, doesn't want to take them, can you just force them on someone?
Oh, if they don't want to take them. Yeah, I don't know. Not sure.
Yeah, we don't really know how that works.
But at least, I would assume that that did happen. I know this is a hypothetical that didn't happen in the chapter, but... If that was the case, I'm assuming Mirabella would probably be incentivized to do that, because then she basically replaces Belanda with her memories, right? Almost like Odrade did with Terraza. It's kind of a similar situation.
Potentially, or at least make herself more valuable as the holder of those memories. At any rate, Belanda recognizes that Duncan has kept Mirabella away from this interaction specifically to protect her. Not that he's worried about Mirabella's survival, but to protect her from the consequences of... her having to protect Duncan, and or just attacking Belanda out of sheer rage for what Belanda's trying to pull here.
Yep.
Which I could definitely see. Duncan also indicates that the child Gola is an even better protector than Mirabella. And Belanda wonders if this indicates that Duncan knows anything about Miles's alleged abilities that were displayed on Camus. Of course, this means the original Miles. However, Duncan indicates that it's a more subtle protection. He knows that if Miles watches Belanda kill Duncan, he will never willingly serve the Bene Gesserit and would be ruined for their purposes. So it's an incentive for Belanda not to murder Duncan in front of him. So it's just kind of an extra layer of making her think before she acts of the potential consequences.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. So Duncan pleads his case to Belanda that he is a Mentat and a Talaxu experiment, but not a Kvisetch Haderach. He also calls her out for apparent deceptions and even basic data that he's being fed, apparently, with the ship systems indicating weather that doesn't match the seasons or the appearances of visitors to the new ship. They trade some Mentat philosophy before Miles chimes in to ask if Belanda was really going to kill Duncan. And she doesn't deny it, but instead simply states, safely for any watchers, that she still believes he's too dangerous. So she doesn't say, like, yes, I was going to kill him, but she also doesn't outright lie and say, no, I wasn't. She just kind of states the rationale for why she would kill him, if indeed she was planning to. Miles is displeased, not apparently at the general idea of murder, but more of, well, you can't do that. Duncan's going to give me back my memories, and what will I do if you kill him? Duncan seems to be trying to establish a sort of alliance or at least a detente with Belanda, but instead of being receptive, she schemes as to how she can turn this around to destroy him in a different way. But she knows that if she pulls it off, the Kamais must show her warning Duncan, a sort of, oh, well, I tried to give him an out, and it didn't work. And throughout this interaction, Miles keeps chiming in to ask for explanation or giving commentary. After some back and forth, Duncan claims that he has logicked his way to the conclusion that there is disagreement among the highest levels of Bene Gesserit leadership, describing it as anarchy. Belanda basically shrugs, saying that there can be deliberation and judgment even in anarchy, causing Duncan to accuse her of hypocrisy, which he cannot believe a Mentat and a Reverend Mother would be guilty of, which strangely shakes her to her core, an involuntary reaction that momentarily makes her fear that he has actually used the voice on her. She can't look away and doesn't understand what exactly he's done, much less how. She realizes that this is as much a performance for the watching Kamais as for her, and she can't help but be impressed by his acting, although she is still terrified. He starts to insult her, asking why on earth the other sisters tolerate such a hypocrite and criminal among them, wondering aloud whether she is a necessary evil who sometimes provides useful data and advice. She manages to spit a "how dare you" at him, but he ignores it, cruelly twisting the knife by saying that, in fact, she is tolerated specifically because her weakness makes her sister strong, because they must become stronger to reinforce her own failings. Blonda is barely keeping herself in mentat mode, suddenly afraid that what he says is true and that this is how Odrade thinks of her. Which I'm pretty sure we saw in a previous chapter isn't totally wrong. Like, I'm pretty sure Odrade had this exact thought before.
Mm-hmm.
When she was thinking about how her assistants are all old and should be replaced and wondering if she should replace Blonda as well as Tamlane. And I think she has this thought about, like, well, Blonda's got some issues, but her failings make us all stronger or something.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine Blonda would be thrilled to be thought of in this way. So hearing this from Duncan and having the realization that, like, it might be true, at least partially, you can understand that that would be difficult to hear.
Yep.
Duncan continues by laying out the criminal disobedience she had planned to commit today, of goading him into a fight in front of the Kamais so she could plead that she had no choice but to kill him. Somehow this last bit restores her mentat state, and she finds herself fascinated by whatever game he's playing. She seems to recover her confidence, thinking that at the end of this encounter, she'll have the fascinating recording of it, but the outcome would be no different, implying that she still thinks she can maneuver events so that he ends up dead, although I'm not quite sure how. Duncan argues with her that the Sisterhood needs him, not just as a mentat, but as a creative force that was able to survive the wrath of Leto the Tyrant on many an occasion. Even if many other times he died, which Blonda points out he has told them before. So he's like, I survived Leto's wrath all these times. And she's like, yeah, and he also crushed you with his giant worm body many other times. He counters that he thought she didn't trust him, kind of turning it back on her of, oh, you're quoting my own words back to me, but I thought I was untrustworthy. Even if she does make a good point that he was killed by Leto a number of times. But he argues that if the sisters don't try something new, they're going to be doomed eventually. Miles chimes in to say that the Bashar could help the sisters, and Duncan doesn't disagree, but he says that the Bashar won't be enough. He describes both himself and Blonda as underdogs and asks if they must continue to fight, but she initially tries to cast this as just more of what he has said before. Duncan launches into an indictment of the Sisterhood scattering, arguing that all the people they are sending out are just fodder for slaughter, and that no Reverend Mother who has been sent out has ever sent even a message back, which he is appalled that the Sisterhood hasn't interpreted as the very bad sign that he sees it is. He even makes the argument that they are actually creating more enemies and feeding the ranks of the Honored Matres, who are perhaps suborning the scattered Reverend Mothers themselves through their sexual imprinting. She demands to know if this is something Rebella has told him, and he reveals that according to her, the Matres are trained to not allow themselves to enjoy sex so much that they get addicted to it, I think, but they're still vulnerable to the imprinting, which I assume indicates that the sisters would be as well. Blonda points out that Mirabella has consistently denied that the Bene Gesserit are predecessors of the Matres, which seems ridiculous on its face, as we've discussed. And accordingly, Duncan points out that this is because Mirabella was conditioned to believe this. So, whether deliberately or just over the passage of time and wanting to deny their roots, the Matres, like, disavow any connection with the Bene Gesserit of the Empire before the scattering.
Mm-hmm.
Duncan then throws her for another loop by addressing her by the old formal term for a Bene Gesserit council member, Mater Felicissima, which has the desired effect of grounding her as a mentat and a Reverend Mother with all of her other memories behind her. She recognizes, as will those watching from the Kamais, that Leto must have taught him to do this. Suddenly, this seems to convince her that he might be a valuable tool who could free the Bene Gesserit even if he is dangerous. So, for some reason, this is the thing that starts to break her resistance to the idea that Duncan is more valuable alive than dead.
Mm-hmm.
Watching her, Duncan informs her that in a past life, he had traveled to Wallach 9 and spoken to our very old friend, the Reverend Mother Tertius Helen Antaeac, who is apparently one of Blonda's maternal ancestors. So I can't say that I expected her to make another appearance in the series.
Nice throwback, though.
Mm-hmm. Duncan had been sent there to suppress the Mentat school that the sisters had believed they'd managed to hide, which tracks with the fact that I think it was made clear in God Emperor that Antaeac was basically a secret Mentat, which of course was outlawed at the time. The memory of Antaeac displays the events in question to Blonda via Simulflow. She recounts the history of the Mentat Order, ending with their suppression under Leto and eventual spreading into the scattering post-famine. Duncan poses the question to Blonda, where have the scattered sisters gone? And Blonda is forced to acknowledge that they have no way of knowing at this point. She finally recognizes that if they are to use Duncan, they are wasting his talents without giving him full data access. So confirming that she's been restricting that. She stands to leave, and he apparently offhandedly comments that the Honored Matres might be a relatively small group. And she's incredulous at this description, given how the Sisterhood is currently being overrun by the vast forces of the Matres on all of their planets. But he raises the upsetting possibility that they may have fled back to the old Empire from something even worse out in the universe. She points out that he has suggested this before, to Odrade, though Duncan notes with pleasure that she refers to Odrade as Dar here, even in front of him. Duncan suggests to her that he and Mirbella might be able to help the sisters with Cytale, with Mirbella gathering information and Duncan using his Mentat skills to interpret it. She smiles at this, in a way that Duncan very much doesn't like, although it's not clear why. She asks for elaboration, and he says something about letting their imaginations run free, and brings up the hypothetical idea of a person who could see through a no-shield, or even an entire no-planet. And she is grudgingly impressed that he has been able to put together the Sisterhood's suspicions about the late Bashar's mysterious abilities, because apparently he was able to see through no-shields. Valanda does sniff derisively that the energy expenditure for an entire no-planet would be inconceivable, but he basically says that anything is possible in the Scattering. So I think the idea here is that he's like, well, it's possible that there are whole no-planets that are out there that you can't see, but maybe it'd be useful if you had someone who could, like implying that if they restore Miles' memories, he could possibly do that. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, that does seem to be what they're getting at, though.
Yeah. So Belanda's like, okay, cool, but we still can't do that now, so what else have you got as an idea? And he basically tells her to have the Bene Gesserit look into their genetic records for common patterns in Atreides' inheritance for new talents. Which kind of seems like it's already the Breeding Mistress's job. Like, wouldn't they already be looking at the traits and inherited? Like, that's the whole purpose of the breeding program. So I don't know what novel thing he's suggesting here. It's a little bit confusing. I guess he's trying to tell her to identify genes for seeing through prescient shields or something, but, like, if they don't know that that trait exists, I don't know how they would ever identify it in the genes. They have the one example of maybe Miles.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit unclear of what he's trying to suggest that they do here that they haven't already been doing. In any case, Valanda wonders what he's trying to do, both for her and the Kamais, with his so-called mad suggestions of no planet and magic anti-prescient shield seers. She thinks on the no planet energy problem, and asks if he thinks that someone out in the Scattering has found a way around the issue of exponential growth in power needed for increasing prescient shield sizes. He doesn't give a good answer, instead just arguing that you don't need to fully understand something to use it, like the Ixians do with Holtzman's unification concept, apparently. Belanda wonders why he's brought up the Ixians, whom the Bene Gesserit don't trust. He asks if she's never wondered why Leto had never suppressed Ix the way he did the Tlaxu, Mentats, Bene Gesserit, and so on, and reveals that it was apparently because Leto was fascinated by their studies into the merging of humans and machine, including but not limited to cyborgs, which seems kind of a new concept in these books, aside from the Tlaxu eyes that were in Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't think of another cyborg-like example.
Yeah, it hasn't come up from what we've seen.
Okay. Valanda is disgusted by the idea, as even the Bene Gesserit share in the revulsion left over from the Butlerian Jihad and his distrust of machines. She seems to scoff at the idea that machines could help humans surpass their limits, but also at the idea that the tyrant subscribed to the idea of machine intelligence, both words capitalized, whatever exactly that means, because it does not get further elaboration. I guess it could just mean that she thinks Duncan is implying that Leto supported the development of thinking machines, and she can't believe that even Leto would support such a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do know that he definitely bent the rules around that, though, because, you know, he did allow some sort of computing devices for his own agents.
He did, although they seemed entirely just for messaging. Mm-hmm. Like, I never got the impression that they were used for any actual computing.
Well, he was also willing to sort of, like, turn a blind eye to whatever the Ixians were doing.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I just mean, there wasn't any indication that he was actually trying to develop intelligent machines for his own use. But yeah, I guess the Ixians were doing some, I don't know, cyborg stuff too, and he was interested in that. I don't know.
But whatever they were doing, he was aware of it because he was prescient, and he wasn't stopping them.
Mm-hmm.
So he was essentially allowing it to happen, because he certainly had the power to stop them from doing anything he wanted to stop them from doing.
Yeah, for the most part. So yeah, we don't get any more elaboration on this, but B'Elanda just completely dismisses the idea for now. But Duncan has a few more points to make before she goes. First, he says that she should be more interested in Shiana and her apparent immunity to sexual bonding, since neither she nor the men Duncan sends to her end up imprinted, even with Shiana's practicing of honored Matre sex skills or whatever. At this revelation, B'Elanda is horrified that she had so shortly before been planning to eliminate such a useful tool. So she's really turned around on the whole Duncan question. Fairly quickly.
Yep.
Then Duncan raises the question of the Futars, which he had seen on Gamu, asking why he had been told that they hunted and killed honored Matres, as Mirbella has no memory of this. B'Elanda says nothing, leaving him, fully believing that he is even more dangerous than she had suspected, but that it is a necessary danger for the present at least. So she might get murderous again in the future, I guess, but for now, Duncan is safe-ish. The Futar question is a little confusing, because he's like, well, where is this information coming from? We've never had any confirmation, like, from external sources, or, like, I don't know where you're getting the information that the Futars hunt honored Matres, but from the honored Matres perspective, it seems pretty clear that the Futars hunted them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from things Spider Queen has said, I thought.
Yeah, unless he's trying to suggest that maybe the Futars were designed to hunt Bene Gesserit, and, like, the honored Matres are, like, the next best thing, so they tend to go after them, but maybe they had a different purpose initially.
Maybe. Or he's just wondering what the source of the information is, because
mm-hmm.
they presumably aren't getting it from the honored Matres themselves, so who shared that information?
Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't quite clear what point he was trying to make with that observation. Especially because B'Elanda doesn't engage in the point and just, like, leaves.
Yeah.
So, with B'Elanda having left and not attempted to kill him, Duncan thanks young Miles for being there, and for mostly staying quiet despite the distressing situation. Miles asks if B'Elanda really would have killed Duncan, who says that she might have if Miles had not gotten him a few seconds at the beginning, because she fears that Duncan might be another Kvisetch Haderach. Miles promises that Duncan is safe now, though Duncan believes it's only a reprieve. But he thinks that he's established a new relationship with B'Elanda. Not that he ties emotions to relationships, apparently not even with Mirbella, given their mutual deep-down resentment of their bond to each other. And even his quasi-friendship with Odrade is suspect, because she is a Reverend Mother and cannot be trusted. He does think that he has at least gained himself access to new data, and that he can now most likely trust the information that the Reverend Mothers give him, which he hadn't entirely before. Miles asks if he can go find Mirbella, who has promised to teach him something that he doesn't think even the Bashar knew, fighting with his feet. And we have learned that the legs are a formidable weapon for the honored Matres.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's kind of adorable that he's just like, she's going to go teach me how to do fancy kicks. He's just so excited. And I feel like it's probably nice for Mirbella to be able to interact with someone who doesn't have, like, a specific hold on or interest in her. Mm-hmm. Like, someone she's not bonded to, someone she's not a prisoner of, who just is, like, wants to engage with her for herself, especially since she's never been able to interact with any of her own actual children.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I kind of like that they kind of hang out even separately from Duncan sometimes. So, Duncan does chastise Miles for saying the Bashar rather than I, but then sends him on his way. However, he cautions him not to tell Mirbella about B'Elanda, as Duncan wants to do this himself. He then recalls seeing Cytale staring from behind the barrier in the hallway. And he wonders what the Talaxu master might be learning here in the special school of the No-Ship. He doesn't like thinking of the Talaxu, which reminds him of the face dancers and their imprinting abilities and the old couple from his visions. Also reminds him that he's a Talaxu experiment. But these fears are not something he can share with the Bene Gesserit. He settles himself into Mirbella's quarters to wait for her, looking at her various training tools for Bene Gesserit practice and mentally critiquing the general disarray of her rooms. So, she definitely seems to be more of the messy type.
Mm-hmm.
When she arrives, he tells her that he's discovered something new about the sisters, and her eyes light up in pride at Duncan's discovery. As he tells her this discovery, he repeats all the quotes he had collected from her in the previous chapter. The immovable game piece, the willing participation in the Bene Gesserit's dreams, and the excuses for extraordinary behavior. Basically, he tells her that the sisters want him to help build a religion around Shiana, but also to serve as the sisterhood's conscience by making them question their behavior. They then discuss B'Elanda's visit, and Mirbella chastises him for not having her there for protection. He describes what happened, and she's livid, threatening that she would never have cooperated with the sisters again if he had been harmed. This was the reaction that he wanted, and he hopes the Bene Gesserit see it as a needed warning that they should think about the consequences of their actions. They then shower together, and Mirbella thinks about her love for him, and how she had never just woken up one day and thought, I love him, but instead it had grown solely inside them both via their addiction to each other to the point that it was just completely natural and a part of them. She resolves that the sisterhood is wrong, that their love is a flaw. They then screw in the shower, and she seems oddly astounded at the idea that part of the reason their sex is so great is not just their mad skills, but that he actually wants to please her. And it's just like, yes, that is how it should work. This should not be a novel realization. In bed afterwards, they discuss the plans to use Shiana for the missionary Protectiva, which is dangerous and puts the sisterhood in an unusually exposed position. Duncan also points out that no one can really control Shiana, and he calls out to Belle via the comm eyes that she has more than one tiger by the tail. Back in the archives, Belanda has returned, with the sister on the comm eyes telling her that Belanda and Rebella are in the shower again, and it gets boring after a while, which is both funny and horrific. Oh, we've invaded their privacy so much that watching them fuck in the shower is boring. Belanda heads off to her quarters, needing to reorder her perceptions and priorities. First, she recognizes that Duncan is a better mentat than she is, so props to her for acknowledging that, I guess. Second, she recognizes that she's jealous of Shiana, and that Duncan is aware of this. It seems like she's jealous of Shiana's participation in the Honored Matre sexual practices, which she finds both dangerous and compelling at the same time, I think. But Belanda and most of her sisters would also be susceptible to the effects of the techniques if they engage them, while Shiana is somehow immune. So that point has been raised several times now, and presumably will be important later for some reason. And that's the end of the chapter. So Rebella gets her chance to execute Duncan, and he manages to talk her out of it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to some help from a child.
Yes.
Just being there.
Exactly. That you wouldn't murder me in front of this 10-year-old, would you? But it works.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little frustrating because, like, there's been literal years of Belanda arguing with Odrade about this point and having the chance to interact with Duncan, and she's never been convinced until just now in this one critical conversation. And then she goes from, like, grudging acceptance, but like, oh my god, I can't believe I was thinking of killing you an hour ago. Like, she is completely 180s on this in the span of, like, I don't know, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a little bit frustrating as, like, a plot aspect, but whatever. At least we don't need to worry about hearing yet another conversation between Belanda and Odrade about whether or not Duncan should be murdered. So, there's that.
Yeah, I think it's also sort of the impact of the fact that they actually have a conversation. Because a lot of this stuff that Belanda's been brewing over is just based on, like, what she's seeing from the calm eyes and, like, conversations she's having with other Bene Gesserit and her other memory and whatever other knowledge she has, and not necessarily hearing his perspective. So I think having, you know, the ability to actually converse with him and learn some things has helped to change her mind a bit as well.
I guess. I got the impression that they'd spoken before, and she certainly had the opportunity to talk to him on the no-ship any number of times before now. But I guess this just kind of goes in with our portrait of her personality, of that she's a mentat and she's a skilled Bene Gesserit, but she's also somewhat potentially impulsive and, as we've heard many times, vicious.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of gets the better of her. So yeah, hopefully when we pick up next time, Odrade will have actually made it to the desert. We can hope.
We can hope.
But. And perhaps Dortujla will have been brought to Junction.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll get some progress on Miles' memories. Guess we'll have to see, but hoping we get some forward movement on the main plot.
Yeah, we've at least gotten some movement here and there with a couple things, and I think the chapters this time around were definitely more interesting than the ones last time around.
Yes.
But yeah, it would be nice to get a little bit more motion, mm-hmm. for sure.
And yeah, again, like I said before, I didn't really mind the first chapter in that it kind of, you know, we didn't get to where we were going, but we at least got to kind of see the impacts of the planet desertification on the other people living here outside of Central, and I think that was a useful perspective.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I would like Odrade to finally talk to Shiana.
Yeah, it's not how much time you spend, it's what you put in the time you spend, and when it's something like that and you're learning more about Chapter House and how it works and some other perspectives rather than, you know, Odrade dancing with a chef about an oyster soup recipe, like,
yes,
it really depends on what the content is.
Agreed.
No.
All right, anything else to add?
I don't think so. Till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Elaine.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice, and be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.